and my eyes were compass needles being pulled toward it. And after I looked at him for a while, I found it really easy to imagine that he was a nice guy. I didn't know anything about him. I couldn't even hear what he was talking about. But I wanted to get to know him. It was kind of odd, but definitely not in a bad way.
From a netcast of EduNews on the American College Network. In the latest on the Pendleton University Caliagnosia Initiative, EduNews has received evidence that the public relations firm of Wyatt Hayes paid 4 Pendleton students to dissuade classmates from voting for the initiative without having them register their affiliations. Evidence includes an internal memo from Wyatt Hayes proposing that good-looking students with high reputation ratings be sought, and records of payments from the agency to Pendleton students. The files were sent by the Semiotech Warriors, a culture-jamming group responsible for numerous acts of media vandalism. When contacted about this story, Wyatt Hayes issued a statement decrying this violation of their internal computer systems. Jeff Winthrop. Yes, it's true. Wyatt Hayes paid me. But it wasn't an endorsement deal. They never told me what to say. They just made it possible for me to devote more time to the anti-Cali campaign, which is what I would have done anyway if I hadn't needed to make money tutoring. All I've been doing is expressing my honest opinion. I think Cali's a bad idea. A couple of people in the anti-Cali campaign have asked that I not speak publicly about the issue anymore because they think it would hurt the cause. I'm sorry they feel that way, because this is just an ad hominem attack. If you thought my arguments made sense before, this shouldn't change anything. But I realize that some people can't make those distinctions, and I'll do what's best for the cause.
Maria D'Souza. Those students really should have registered their affiliations. We all know people who are walking endorsements, but now, whenever someone criticizes the initiative, people ask them if they're being paid. The backlash is definitely hurting the anti-Cali campaign. I consider it a compliment that someone is taking enough interest in the initiative to hire a PR firm. We've always hoped that its passing might influence people at other schools, and this means that corporations are thinking the same thing. We've invited the president of the National Caliagnosia Association to speak on campus. Before, we weren't sure if we wanted to bring the national group in, because they have a different emphasis than we do. They're more focused on the media uses of beauty, while here at C, we're more interested in the social equality issue. But given the way students reacted to what Wyatt Hayes did, it's clear that the media manipulation issue has the power to get us where we need to go. Our best shot at getting the initiative passed is to take advantage of the anger against advertisers. The social equality will follow afterwards.
From the speech given at Pendleton by Walter Lambert, president of the National Caliagnosia Association. Think of cocaine. In its natural form as coca leaves, it's appealing, but not to an extent that it usually becomes a problem. But refine it, purify it, and you get a compound that hits your pleasure receptors with an unnatural intensity. That's when it becomes addictive. Beauty has undergone a similar process, thanks to advertisers. Evolution gave us a circuit that responds to good looks. Call it the pleasure receptor for our visual cortex. And in our natural environment, it was useful to have. But take a person with 1 in a million skin and bone structure. Add professional makeup and retouching, and you're no longer looking at beauty in its natural form. You've got pharmaceutical-grade beauty, the cocaine of good looks. Biologists call this supernormal stimulus. Show a mother bird a giant plastic egg, and she'll incubate it instead of her own real eggs. Madison Avenue has saturated our environment with this kind of stimuli, this visual drug. Our beauty receptors receive more stimulation than they were evolved to handle. We're seeing more beauty in one day than our ancestors did in a lifetime. And the result is that beauty is slowly ruining our lives. How? The way any drug becomes a problem. By interfering with our relationships with other people. We become dissatisfied with the way ordinary people look because they can't compare to supermodels. Two-dimensional images are bad enough, but now with specs, advertisers can put a supermodel right in front of you, making eye contact. Software companies offer goddesses who remind you of your appointments. We've all heard about men who prefer virtual girlfriends over actual ones, but they're not the only ones who've been affected. The more time any of us spend with gorgeous digital apparitions around, the more our relationships with real human beings are going to suffer. We can't avoid these images and still live in the modern world. And that means we can't kick this habit, because beauty is a drug you can't abstain from unless you literally keep your eyes closed all the time. Until now. Now you can get another set of eyelids, one that blocks out this drug, but still lets you see. And that's caliagnosia. Some people call it excessive, but I call it just enough. Technology is being used to manipulate us through our emotional reactions. So it's only fair that we use it to protect ourselves, too. Right now, you have an opportunity to make an enormous impact. The Pembleton student body has always been at the vanguard of every progressive movement. What you decide here will set an example for students across the country. By passing this initiative, by adopting caliagnosia, you'll be sending a message to advertisers that young people are no longer willing to be manipulated. From a netcast of EduNews. Following NCA President Walter Lambert's speech, polls show that 54% of the Pembleton University students support the Caliagnosia initiative. Polls across the country show that an average of 28% of students would support a similar initiative at their school, an increase of 8% in the past month.
Tamara Lyons. I thought he went overboard with that cocaine analogy. Do you know anyone who steals stuff and sells it so he can get his fix of advertising? But I guess he has a point about how good-looking people are in commercials versus in real life. It's not that they look better than people in real life, but they look good in a different way. Like, I was at the campus store the other day, and I needed to check my email. And when I put on my specs, I saw this poster running a commercial. It was for some shampoo, Jouissance, I think. I'd seen it before, but it was different without Callie. The model was so... I couldn't take my eyes off her. I don't mean I felt the same as that time I saw the good-looking guy in the cafeteria. It wasn't like I wanted to get to know her. It was more like watching a sunset or a fireworks display. I just stood there and watched the commercial like 5 times, just so I could look at her some more. I didn't think a human being could look so, you know, spectacular. But it's not like I'm going to quit talking to people so I can watch commercials through my specs all the time. Watching them is very intense, but it's a totally different experience than looking at a real person. And it's not even like I immediately want to go out and buy everything they're selling either. I'm not even really paying attention to the products. I just think they're amazing to watch. Maria D'Souza. If I'd met Tamara earlier, I might have tried to persuade her not to get her Cali turned off. I doubt I would have succeeded. She seems pretty firm about her decision. Even so, she's a great example of the benefits of Cali. You can't help but notice it when you talk to her. For example, at one point I was saying how lucky she was, and she said, "Because I'm beautiful?" And she was being totally sincere, like she was talking about her height. Can you imagine a woman without Cali saying that? Tamara is completely unselfconscious about her looks. She's not vain or insecure, and she can describe herself as beautiful without embarrassment. I gather that she's very pretty, and with a lot of women who look like that, I can see something in their manner, a hint of show-offishness. Tamara doesn't have that, or else they display false modesty, which is also easy to tell. But Tamara doesn't do that either, because she truly is modest. There's no way she could be like that if she hadn't been raised with Cali. I just hope she stays that way. Annika Lindstrom, second-year student. I think this Cali thing is a terrible idea. I like it when guys notice me, and I'd be really disappointed if they stopped. I think this whole thing is just a way for people who, honestly, aren't very good-looking, to try and make themselves feel better. And the only way they can do that is to punish people who have what they don't. And that's just unfair. Who wouldn't want to be pretty if they could? Ask anyone. Ask the people behind this. And I'd bet you they'd all say yes. Okay, sure. Being pretty means that you'll be hassled by jerks sometimes. There are always jerks. But that's part of life. If those scientists could come up with some way to turn off the jerk circuit in guys' brains, I'd be all in favor of that. Jolene Carter, third-year student. I'm voting for the initiative, because I think it'd be a relief if everyone had Cali. People are nice to me because of how I look, and part of me likes that. But part of me feels guilty because I haven't done anything to deserve it. And sure, it's nice to have men pay attention to me, but it can be hard to make a real connection with someone. Whenever I like a guy, I always wonder how much he's interested in me versus how much he's interested in my looks. It can be hard to tell, because all relationships are wonderful at the beginning, you know? It's not until later that you find out whether you can be really comfortable with each other. It was like that with my last boyfriend. He wasn't happy with me if I didn't look fabulous, so I was never able to truly relax. But by the time I realized that, I had already let myself get close to him, so that really hurt, finding out that he didn't see the real me. And then there's how you feel around other women. I don't think most women like it, but you're always comparing how you look relative to everyone else. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a competition, and I don't want to be. I thought about getting Cali once, but it didn't seem like it would help unless everyone else did too. Getting it all by myself wouldn't change the way others treat me. But if everyone on campus had Cali, I'd be glad to get it. Tamara Lyons. I was showing my roommate Ina this album of pictures from high school, and we get to all these pictures of me and Garrett, my ex. So Ina wants to know all about him, and so I tell her. I'm telling her how we were together all of senior year, and how much I loved him, and wanted us to stay together, but he wanted to be free to date when he went to college. And then she's like, "You mean he broke up with you?" It took me a while before I could get her to tell me what was up. She made me promise twice not to get mad. Eventually, she said, "Garrett isn't exactly good-looking. I was thinking he must be average-looking, because he didn't really look that different after I got my Cali turned off. But Ina said he was definitely below average." She found pictures of a couple other guys who she thought looked like him, and with them I could see how they're not good-looking. Their faces just look goofy. Then I took another look at Garrett's picture, and I guess he's got some of the same features, but on him they look cute, to me anyway. I guess it's true what they say. Love is a little bit like Cali. When you love someone, you don't really see what they look like. I don't see Garrett the way others do, because I still have feelings for him. Ina said she couldn't believe someone who looked like him would break up with someone who looked like me. She said that in a school without Cali, he probably wouldn't have been able to get a date with me. Like, we wouldn't be in the same league. That's weird to think about. When Garrett and I were going out, I always thought we were meant to be together. I don't mean that I believe in destiny, but I just thought there was something really right about the two of us. So the idea that we could have both been in the same school, but not gotten together because we didn't have Cali, feels strange. And I know that Ina can't be sure of that, but I can't be sure she's wrong either. And maybe that means I should be glad I had Cali, because it let me and Garrett get together. I don't know about that.
From a netcast of EduNews. Net sites for a dozen Cali Agnosia student organizations around the country were brought down today in a coordinated denial-of-service attack. Although no one has claimed credit for the attack, it's been suggested that those responsible may be retaliating for an incident last month in which the American Association of Cosmetic Surgeons net site was replaced by a Cali Agnosia site. In a related story, the Semiotech warriors announced the release of their new dermatology computer virus. This virus has quickly begun infecting video servers around the world, altering netcasts so that faces and bodies exhibit conditions such as acne and varicose veins. Warren Davidson, first-year student. I thought about trying Cali before when I was in high school, but I never knew how to bring it up with my parents. So when they started offering it here, I figured I'd give it a try. Shrugs. It's okay. Actually, it's better than okay. I've always hated how I look. For a while in high school, I couldn't stand the sight of myself in a mirror. But with Cali, I don't mind as much. I know I look the same to other people, but that doesn't seem as big a deal as it used to. I feel better just by not being reminded that some people are so much better looking than others. Like, for instance, I was helping this girl in the library with a problem on her calculus homework. And afterwards, I realized that she's someone I thought was really pretty. Normally, I would have been really nervous around her. But with Callie, she wasn't so hard to talk to. Maybe she thinks I look like a freak. I don't know. But the thing was, when I was talking to her, I didn't think I looked like a freak. Before I got Callie, I think I was just too self-conscious. And that just made things worse. Now, I'm more relaxed. It's not like I suddenly feel all wonderful about myself or anything, and I'm sure for other people, Cali wouldn't help them at all, but for me, Cali makes me not feel as bad as I used to. And that's worth something. Alex Bebescu, professor of religious studies at Pendleton. Some people have been quick to dismiss the whole Kali-agnosia debate as superficial, an argument over makeup or who can and can't get a date. But if you actually look at it, you'll see it's much deeper than that. It reflects a very old ambivalence about the body, one that's been part of Western civilization since ancient times. You see, the foundations of our culture were laid in classical Greece, where physical beauty and the body were celebrated. But our culture is also thoroughly permeated by the monotheistic tradition, which devalues the body in favor of the soul. These old conflicting impulses are rearing their heads again, this time in the Kali-agnosia debate. I suspect that most Kali supporters think of themselves to be modern secular liberals and wouldn't admit to being influenced by monotheism in any way. But take a look at who else advocates Kali-agnosia. Conservative religious groups. There are communities of all three major monotheistic faiths, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, who've begun using Kali to make their young members more resistant to the charms of outsiders. This commonality is no coincidence. The liberal Kali supporters may not use language like resisting the temptations of the flesh, but in their own way they're following the same tradition of deprecating the physical. Really, the only Kali supporters who can credibly claim they're not influenced by monotheism are the Neo-Mind Buddhists. They're a sect who see Kali-agnosia as a step toward enlightened thought, because it eliminates one's perception of illusory distinctions. But the Neo-Mind sect is open to broad use of neurostat as an aid to meditation, which is a radical stance of an entirely different sort. I doubt you'll find many modern liberals or conservative monotheists sympathetic to that. So, you see, this debate isn't just about commercials and cosmetics. It's about determining what's the appropriate relationship between the mind and the body. Are we more fully realized when we minimize the physical part of our natures? And that, you have to agree, is a profound question. Joseph Weingartner. After Kali-agnosia was discovered, some researchers wondered if it might be possible to create an analogous condition that rendered the subject blind to race or ethnicity. They've made a number of attempts, impairing various levels of category discrimination in tandem with face recognition, that sort of thing. But the resulting deficits were always unsatisfactory. Usually, the test subjects would simply be unable to distinguish similar-looking individuals. One test actually produced a benign variant of Fregoli syndrome, causing the subject to mistake every person he met for a family member. Unfortunately, treating everyone like a brother isn't desirable in so literal a sense. When neurostat treatments for problems like compulsive behavior entered widespread use, a lot of people thought that mind programming was finally here. People asked their doctors if they could get the same sexual tastes as their spouses. Media pundits worried about the possibility of programming loyalty to a government or corporation, or belief in an ideology or religion. The fact is, we have no access to the contents of anyone's thoughts. We can shape broad aspects of personality. We can make changes consistent with the natural specialization of the brain, but these are extremely coarse-grained adjustments. There's no neural pathway that specifically handles resentment toward immigrants, any more than there's one for Marxist doctrine or foot fetishism. If we ever get true mind programming, we'll be able to create race blindness. But until then, education is our best hope.
Tamara Lyons. I had an interesting class today. In History of Ideas, we've got this TA. He's named Anton. And he was saying how a lot of words we use to describe an attractive person used to be words for magic, like the word charm originally meant a magic spell, and the word glamour did too. And it's just blatant with words like enchanting and spellbinding. And when he said that, I thought, yeah, that's what it's like. Seeing a really good-looking person is like having a magic spell cast over you. And Anton was saying how one of the primary uses of magic was to create love and desire in someone. And that makes total sense, too, when you think about those words charm and glamour. Because seeing beauty feels like love. You feel like you've got a crush on a really good-looking person just by looking at them. And I've been thinking that maybe there's a way I can get back together with Garrett. Because if Garrett didn't have Callie, maybe he'd fall in love with me again. Remember how I said before that maybe Callie was what let us get together? Well, maybe Callie is actually what's keeping us apart now. Maybe Garrett would want to get back with me if he saw what I really looked like. Garrett turned 18 during the summer, but he never got his Callie turned off because he didn't think it was a big deal. He goes to Northrop now, so I called him up, just as a friend, and when we were talking about stuff, I asked him what he thought about the Callie initiative here at Pembleton. He said he didn't see what all the fuss was about. And then I told him how much I liked not having Callie anymore, and said he ought to try it, so he could judge both sides. He said that made sense. I didn't make a big deal out of it, but I was stoked.
Daniel Taglia, professor of comparative literature at Pembleton. The student initiative doesn't apply to faculty. But obviously, if it passes, there'll be pressure on the faculty to adopt Kaliagnosia as well. So I don't consider it premature for me to say that I'm adamantly opposed to it. This is just the latest example of political correctness run amok. The people advocating Kali are well-intentioned, but what they're doing is infantilizing us. The very notion that beauty is something we need to be protected from is insulting. Next thing you know, a student organization will insist we all adopt music agnosia, so we don't feel bad about ourselves when we hear gifted singers or musicians. When you watch Olympic athletes in competition, does your self-esteem plummet? Of course not. On the contrary, you feel wonder and admiration. You're inspired that such exceptional individuals exist. So why can't we feel the same way about beauty? Feminism would have us apologize for having that reaction. It wants to replace aesthetics with politics, and to the extent it succeeded, it's impoverished us. Being in the presence of a world-class beauty can be as thrilling as listening to a world-class soprano. Gifted individuals aren't the only ones who benefit from their gifts. We all do. Or should I say, we all can. Depriving ourselves of that opportunity would be a crime. Commercial paid for by People for Ethical Nanomedicine. Voiceover. Have your friends been telling you that Callie is cool? That it's the smart thing to do? Then maybe you should talk to people who grew up with Callie. After I got my Callie turned off, I recoiled the first time I met an unattractive person. I knew it was silly, but I just couldn't help myself. Cali didn't help make me mature. It kept me from becoming mature. I had to relearn how to interact with people. I went to school to be a graphic artist. I worked day and night, but I never got anywhere with it. My teacher said I didn't have the eye for it, that Cali had stunted me aesthetically. There's no way I can get back what I've lost.
Having Cali was like having my parents inside my head, censoring my thoughts. Now that I've had it turned off, I realize just what kind of abuse I've been living with.
Voiceover. If the people who grew up with Cali agnosia don't recommend it, shouldn't that tell you something? They didn't have a choice. But you do. Brain damage is never a good idea, no matter what your friends say.
Maria de Souza. We'd never heard of the People for Ethical Nanomedicine, so we did some research on them. It took some digging, but it turns out it's not a grassroots organization at all. It's an industry PR front. A bunch of cosmetics companies got together recently and created it. We haven't been able to contact the people who appear in the commercial, so we don't know how much, if any, of what they said was true. Even if they were being honest, they certainly aren't typical. Most people who get their Cali turned off feel fine about it. And there are definitely graphic artists who grew up with Cali. It kind of reminds me of an ad I saw a while back, put out by a modeling agency when the Cali movement was just getting started. It was just a picture of a supermodel's face with a caption, "If you no longer saw her as beautiful, whose loss would it be, hers or yours?" This new campaign has the same message, basically saying, "You'll be sorry." But instead of taking that cocky attitude, it has more of a concerned warning tone. This is classic PR. Hide behind a nice-sounding name and create the impression of a third party looking out for the consumer's interests. Tamara Lyons. I thought that commercial was totally idiotic. It's not like I'm in favor of the initiative. I don't want people to vote for it, but people shouldn't vote against it for the wrong reason. Growing up with Cali isn't crippling. There's no reason for anyone to feel sorry for me or anything. I'm dealing with it fine. And that's why I think people ought to vote against the initiative, because seeing beauty is fine. Anyway, I talked to Garrett again. He said he'd just gotten his Cali turned off. He said it seemed cool so far, although it was kind of weird, and I told him I felt the same way when I got mine disabled. I suppose it's kind of funny how I was acting like an old pro, even though I've only had mine off for a few weeks.
Joseph Weingartner. One of the first questions researchers asked about Cali agnosia was whether it has any spillover, that is, whether it affects your appreciation of beauty outside of faces. For the most part, the answer seems to be no. Cali agnosics seem to enjoy looking at the same things other people do. That said, we can't rule out the possibility of side effects. As an example, consider the spillover that's observed in prosopagnosics. One prosopagnosic who was a dairy farmer found he could no longer recognize his cows individually. Another found it harder to distinguish models of cars, if you can imagine that. These cases suggest that we sometimes use our face recognition module for tasks other than strict face recognition. We may not think something looks like a face, a car, for example, but at a neurological level, we're treating it as if it were a face. There may be a similar spillover among Cali agnosics, but since Cali agnosia is subtler than prosopagnosia, any spillover is harder to measure. The role of fashion in cars' appearances, for example, is vastly greater than its role in faces. And there's little consensus about which cars are most attractive. There may be a Cali agnosic out there who doesn't enjoy looking at certain models as much as he otherwise would, but he hasn't come forward to complain. Then there's the role our beauty recognition module plays in our aesthetic reaction to symmetry. We appreciate symmetry in a wide range of settings. Painting, sculpture, graphic design. But at the same time, we also appreciate asymmetry. There are a lot of factors that contribute to our reaction to art, and not much consensus about when a particular example is successful. It might be interesting to see if Kaliagnosia communities produce fewer truly talented visual artists. But given how few such individuals arise in the general population, it's difficult to do a statistically meaningful study. The only thing we know for certain is that Kaliagnosics report a more muted response to some portraits. But that's not a side effect per se. Portrait paintings derive at least some of their impact from the facial appearance of the subject. Of course, any effect is too much for some people. This is the reason given by some parents for not wanting Kaliagnosia for their children. They want their children to be able to appreciate the Mona Lisa, and perhaps create its successor. Mark Esposito, fourth-year student at Waterston College. That Pendleton thing sounds totally crazed. I could see doing it like a setup for some prank, you know, as in you'd fix this guy up with a girl and tell him she's an absolute babe, but actually you fixed him up with a dog, and he can't tell, so he believes you. That'd be kind of funny, actually. But I sure as hell would never get this Cali thing. I want to date good-looking girls. Why would I want something that'd make me lower my standards? Okay, sure, some nights all the babes have been taken, and you have to choose from the leftovers, but that's why there's beer, right? Doesn't mean I want to wear beer goggles all the time.
Tamara Lyons. So Garrett and I were talking on the phone again last night, and I asked him if he wanted to switch to video so we could see each other, and he said okay, so we did. I was casual about it, but I had actually spent a lot of time getting ready. Ina's teaching me to put on makeup, but I'm not very good at it yet. I got that phone software that makes it look like you're wearing makeup. I set it for just a little bit, and I think it made a real difference in how I looked. Maybe it was overkill. I don't know how much Garrett could tell, but I just wanted to be sure I looked as good as possible. As soon as we switched to video, I could see him react. It was like his eyes got wider. He was like, "You look really great," and I was like, "Thanks." Then he got shy and made some joke about the way he looked, but I told him I liked the way he looked. We talked for a while on video, and all the time I was really conscious of him looking at me. That felt good. I got a feeling that he was thinking he might want us to get back together again, but maybe I was just imagining it. Maybe next time we talk, I'll suggest he could come visit me for a weekend, or I could go visit him at Northrop. That'd be really cool, though I'd have to be sure I could do my own makeup before that. I know there's no guarantee that he'll want to get back together. Getting my Cali turned off didn't make me love him less, so maybe it won't make him love me anymore. I'm hoping, though. Kathy Minami, third-year student. Anyone who says the Cali movement is good for women is spreading the propaganda of all oppressors. The claim that subjugation is actually protection. Cali supporters want to demonize those women who possess beauty. Beauty can provide just as much pleasure for those who have it as for those who perceive it, but the Cali movement makes women feel guilty about taking pleasure in their appearance. It's yet another patriarchal strategy for suppressing female sexuality, and once again, too many women have bought into it. Of course, beauty has been used as a tool of oppression, but eliminating beauty is not the answer. You can't liberate people by narrowing the scope of their experiences. That's positively Orwellian. What's needed is a woman-centered concept of beauty, one that lets all women feel good about themselves instead of making most of them feel bad.
Lawrence Sutton, fourth-year student. I totally knew what Walter Lambert was talking about in his speech. I wouldn't have phrased it the way he did, but I felt the same way for a while now. I got Cali a couple years ago, long before this initiative came up, because I wanted to be able to concentrate on more important things. I don't mean I only think about schoolwork. I've got a girlfriend, and we have a good relationship. That hasn't changed. What's changed is how I interact with advertising. Before, every time I used to walk past a magazine stand or see a commercial, I could feel my attention being drawn a little bit. It was like they were trying to arouse me against my will. I don't necessarily mean a sexual kind of arousal, but they were trying to appeal to me on a visceral level. And I would automatically resist and go back to whatever I was doing before. But it was a distraction.
and resisting those distractions took energy that I could have been using elsewhere. But now, with Callie, I don't feel that pull. Callie freed me from that distraction. It gave me that energy back. So I'm totally in favor of it.
Lori Harbor, third-year student at Maxwell College.
Callie is for wusses. My attitude is, fight back. Go radical, ugly. That's what the beautiful people need to see. I got my nose taken off about this time last year. It's a bigger deal than it sounds. Surgery-wise, to be healthy and stuff, you have to move some of the hairs further in to catch dust, and the bone you see, taps it with a fingernail, isn't real. It's ceramic. Having your real bone exposed is a big infection risk. I like it when I freak people out. Sometimes I actually ruin someone's appetite when they're eating. But freaking people out, that's not what it's about. It's about how ugly can beat beautiful at its own game. I get more looks walking down the street than a beautiful woman. You see me standing next to a video model, who are you going to notice more? Me, that's who. You won't want to, but you will.
Tamara Lyons. Garrett and I were talking again last night, and we got to talking about, you know, if either of us had been going out with someone else, and I was casual about it. I said that I'd hung out with some guys, but nothing major. So I asked him the same. He was kind of embarrassed about it, but eventually he said that he was finding it harder to, like, really become friendly with girls in college, harder than he expected, and now he's thinking it's because of the way he looks. I just said, no way. But I didn't really know what to say. Part of me was glad that Garrett isn't seeing someone else yet, and part of me felt bad for him, and part of me was just surprised. I mean, he's smart, he's funny, he's a great guy, and I'm not just saying that because I went out with him. He was popular in high school. But then I remembered what Ina said about me and Garrett. I guess being smart and funny doesn't mean you're in the same league as someone you have to be equally good-looking to. And if Garrett's been talking to girls who are pretty, maybe they don't feel like he's in their league. I didn't make a big deal out of it when we were talking, because I don't think he wanted to talk about it a lot. But afterwards, I was thinking that if we decide to do a visit, I should definitely go out to Northrop to see him instead of him coming here. Obviously, I'm hoping something will happen between us, but also, I thought maybe if the other people at his school see us together, he might feel better. Because I know sometimes that works. If you're hanging out with a cool person, you feel cool, and other people think you're cool. Not that I'm super cool, but I guess people like how I look. So I thought it might help. Ellen Hutchinson, professor of sociology at Pembleton.
I admire the students for putting forth this initiative. Their idealism heartens me, but I have mixed feelings about their goal. Like anyone else who's my age, I've had to come to terms with the effects time has had on my appearance. It wasn't an easy thing to get used to, but I've reached the point where I'm content with the way I look. Although I can't deny that I'm curious to see what a Cali-only community would be like. Maybe there a woman my age wouldn't become invisible when a young woman entered the room. But would I have wanted to adopt Cali when I was young? I don't know. I'm sure it would have spared me some of the distress I felt about growing older, but I liked the way I looked when I was young. I wouldn't have wanted to give that up. I'm not sure if, as I grew older, there was ever a point when the benefits would have outweighed the costs for me. And these students, they might never even lose the beauty of youth. With the gene therapies coming out now, they'll probably look young for decades, maybe even their entire lives. They might never have to make the adjustments I did, in which case adopting Cali wouldn't even save them from pain later on. So the idea that they might voluntarily give up one of the pleasures of youth is almost galling. Sometimes I want to shake them and say, no, don't you realize what you have? I've always liked young people's willingness to fight for their beliefs. That's one reason I've never really believed in a cliché that youth is wasted on the young. But this initiative would bring the cliché closer to reality, and I would hate for that to be the case.
Joseph Weingartner. I've tried Kaliagnosia for a day. I've tried a wide variety of agnosias for limited periods. Most neurologists do, so we can better understand these conditions and empathize with our patients. But I couldn't adopt Kaliagnosia on a long-term basis, if for no other reason than that I see patients. There's a slight interaction between Kaliagnosia and the ability to gauge a person's health visually. It certainly doesn't make you blind to things like a person's skin tone, and a Kaliagnosia can recognize symptoms of illness just like anyone else does. This is something that general cognition handles perfectly well, but physicians need to be sensitive to very subtle cues when evaluating a patient. Sometimes you use your intuition when making a diagnosis, and Kaliagnosia would act as a handicap in such situations. Of course, I'd be disingenuous if I claimed that professional requirements were the only thing keeping me from adopting Kaliagnosia. The more relevant question is, would I choose Kaliagnosia if I did nothing but lab research and never dealt with patients? And to that, my answer is no. Like many other people, I enjoy seeing a pretty face, but I consider myself mature enough to not let that affect my judgment.
Tamara Lyons.
I can't believe it. Garrett got his Cali turned back on. We were talking on the phone last night, just ordinary stuff, and I ask him if he wants to switch to video, and he's like, okay, so we do. And then I realize he's not looking at me the same way he was before, so I ask him if everything's okay with him, and that's when he tells me about getting Cali again. He said he did it because he wasn't happy about the way he looked. I asked him if someone had said something about it because he should ignore them, but he said it wasn't that. He just didn't like how he felt when he saw himself in a mirror. So I was like, what are you talking about? You look cute. I tried to get him to give it another chance, saying stuff like, he should spend more time without Cali before making any decisions. Garrett said he'd think about it, but I don't know what he's going to do. Anyway, afterwards, I was thinking about what I'd said to him. Did I tell him that because I don't like Cali, or because I wanted him to see how I looked? I mean, of course I liked the way he looked at me, and I was hoping he would lead somewhere. But it's not as if I'm being inconsistent, is it? If I'd always been in favor of Cali, but made an exception when it came to Garrett, that'd be different. But I'm against Cali, so it's not like that. Oh, who am I kidding? I wanted Garrett to get his Cali turned off for my own benefit, not because I'm anti-Cali. And it's not even that I'm anti-Cali so much as I am against Cali being a requirement. I don't want anyone else deciding Cali is right for me, not my parents, not a student organization. But if someone decides they want Cali themselves, that's fine, whatever. So I should let Garrett decide for himself. I know that. It's just frustrating. I mean, I had this whole plan figured out with Garrett finding me irresistible and realizing what a mistake he'd made. So I'm disappointed. That's all.
From Maria de Souza's speech the day before the election. We've reached a point where we can begin to adjust our minds. The question is, when is it appropriate for us to do so? We shouldn't automatically accept that natural is better, nor should we automatically presume that we can improve on nature. It's up to us to decide which qualities we value and what's the best way to achieve those. I say that physical beauty is something we no longer need. Cali doesn't mean that you'll never see anyone as beautiful. When you see a smile that's genuine, you'll see beauty. When you see an act of courage or generosity, you'll see beauty. Most of all, when you look at someone you love, you'll see beauty. All Cali does is keep you from being distracted by surfaces. True beauty is what you see with the eyes of love, and that's something that nothing can obscure. From the speech netcast by Rebecca Boyer, spokesperson for People for Ethical Nanomedicine, the day before the election. You might be able to create a pure Cali society in an artificial setting, but in the real world, you're never going to get 100% compliance. And that is Cali's weakness. Cali works fine if everybody has it. But if even one person doesn't, that person will take advantage of everyone else. There will always be people who don't get Cali,
You know that. Just think about what those people could do. A manager could promote attractive employees and demote ugly ones, but you won't even notice. A teacher could reward attractive students and punish ugly ones, but you won't be able to tell. All the discrimination you hate could be taking place without you even realizing. Of course, it's possible those things won't happen. But if people could always be trusted to do what's right, no one would have suggested Callie in the first place. In fact, the people prone to such behavior are liable to do it even more once there's no chance of their getting caught. If you're outraged by that sort of lookism, how can you afford to get Callie? You're precisely the type of person who's needed to blow the whistle on that behavior. But if you've got Callie, you won't be able to recognize it. If you want to fight discrimination, keep your eyes open.
From a netcast of EduNews. The Kaliagnosia Initiative, sponsored by students at Pendleton University, was defeated by a vote of 64% to 36%. Polls showed a majority favoring the initiative until days before the election. Many students say they were previously planning to vote for the initiative, but reconsidered after seeing the speech given by Rebecca Boyer of the People for Ethical Nanomedicine. This despite an earlier revelation that PEN was established by cosmetics companies to oppose the Kaliagnosia movement.
Maria de Souza. Of course it's disappointing, but we originally thought of the initiative as a long shot. That period when the majority supported it was something of a fluke. So I can't be too disappointed about people changing their minds. The important thing is that people everywhere are talking about the value of appearances, and more of them are thinking about Callie seriously. And we're not stopping. In fact, the next few years will be a very exciting time. A specs manufacturer just demonstrated some new technology that could change everything. They figured out a way to fit somatic positioning beacons in a pair of specs, custom calibrated for a single person. That means no more helmet, no more office visit needed to reprogram your neurostat. You can just put on your specs and do it yourself. That means you'll be able to turn your Kali on or off any time you want. That means we won't have the problem of people feeling that they have to give up beauty altogether. Instead, we can promote the idea that beauty is appropriate in some situations and not in others. For example, people could keep Kali enabled when they're working, but disable it when they're among friends. I think people recognize that Kali offers benefits and will choose it on at least a part-time basis. I'd say the ultimate goal is for Callie to be considered the proper way to behave in polite society. People can always disable their Callie in private, but the default for public interaction would be freedom from lookism. Appreciating beauty would become a consensual interaction, something you do only when both parties, the beholder and the beheld, agree to it.
From a netcast of EduNews. In the latest developments regarding the Pendleton Kaliagnosia Initiative, EduNews has learned that a new form of digital manipulation was used on the netcast of PEN spokesperson Rebecca Boyer's speech. EduNews has received files from the Semiotech Warriors that contain what appear to be two recorded versions of the speech, an original acquired from the Wyeth Hayes computers, and a netcast version. The files also include the Semiotech Warriors' analysis of the differences between the two versions. The discrepancies are primarily enhancements to Ms. Boyer's voice intonation, facial expressions, and body language. Viewers who watched the original version rate Ms. Boyer's performance as good, while those who watched the edited version rate her performance as excellent, describing her as extraordinarily dynamic and persuasive. Based on their analysis, the Semiotech Warriors believe that Wyeth Hayes has developed new software capable of fine-tuning paralinguistic cues in order to maximize the emotional response evoked in viewers. This dramatically increases the effectiveness of recorded presentations, especially when viewed through specs, and its use in the PEN netcast is likely what caused many supporters of the Kaliagnosia Initiative to change their votes. Walter Lambert, president of the National Kaliagnosia Association.
In my entire career, I've met only a couple people who have the kind of charisma they gave Ms. Boyer in that speech. People like that radiate a kind of reality distortion field that lets them convince you of almost anything. You feel moved by their very presence. You're ready to open your wallet or agree to whatever they ask. It's not until later that you remember all the objections you had, but by then, often as not, it's too late. And I'm truly frightened by the prospect of corporations being able to generate that effect with software. What this is another kind of supernormal stimuli, like flawless beauty, but even more dangerous. We had a defense against beauty, and Wyatt Hayes has escalated things to the next level. And protecting ourselves from this type of persuasion is going to be a hell of a lot harder. There is a type of tonal agnosia, or aprosodia, that makes you unable to hear voice intonation. All you hear are the words, not the delivery. There's also an agnosia that prevents you from recognizing facial expressions. Adopting the two of these would protect you from this type of manipulation, because you have to judge a speech purely on its content. Its delivery would be invisible to you. But I can't recommend them. The result is nothing like Callie. If you can't hear tone of voice or read someone's expression, your ability to interact with others is crippled. It'd be a kind of high-functioning autism. A few NCA members are adopting both agnosias as a form of protest, but no one expects many people will follow their example. So that means that once this software gets into widespread use, we're going to be facing extraordinarily persuasive pitches from all sides. Commercials, press releases, evangelists. We'll hear the most stirring speeches given by a politician or general in decades. Even activists and culture jammers will use it, just to keep up with the establishment. Once the range of the software gets wide enough, even the movies will use it, too. An actor's own ability won't matter, because everyone's performance will be uncanny. The same thing will happen as happened with beauty. Our environment will become saturated with this supernormal stimuli, and it'll affect our interaction with real people. When every speaker on a netcast has the presence of a Winston Churchill or a Martin Luther King, we'll begin to regard ordinary people with their average use of paralinguistic cues as bland and unpersuasive. We'll become dissatisfied with the people we interact with in real life because they won't be as engaging as the projections we see through our specs. I just hope those specs for reprogramming Neurostat hit the market soon. Then maybe we can encourage people to adopt the stronger agnosias just when they're watching video. That may be the only way for us to preserve authentic human interaction, if we save our emotional responses for real life.
Tamara Lyons. I know how this is going to sound, but, well, I'm thinking about getting my Callie turned back on. In a way, it's because of that pen video. I don't mean I'm getting Callie just because makeup companies don't want people to and I'm angry at them. That's not it. But it's hard to explain. I am angry at them because they used a trick to manipulate people. They weren't playing fair. But what it made me realize was, I was doing the same kind of thing to Garrett, or I wanted to anyway. I was trying to use my looks to win him back, and in a way, that's not playing fair either. I don't mean that I'm as bad as the advertisers are. I love Garrett, and they just want to make money. But remember when I was talking about beauty as a kind of magic spell? It gives you an advantage, and I think it's very easy to misuse something like that. And what Callie does is make a person immune to that sort of spell. So I figure I shouldn't mind if Garrett would rather be immune, because I shouldn't be trying to gain an advantage in the first place. If I get him back, I want it to be by playing fair, by him loving me for myself. I know, just because he got his Callie turned back on doesn't mean that I have to. I've really been enjoying seeing what faces look like. But if Garrett's going to be immune, I feel like I should be, too. So we're even, you know? And if we do get back together, maybe we'll get those new specs they're talking about.
Then we can turn off our Callie when we're by ourselves. Just the two of us. And I guess Callie makes sense for other reasons, too. Those makeup companies and everyone else, they're just trying to create needs in you that you wouldn't feel if they were playing fair. And I don't like that. If I'm going to be dazzled watching a commercial, it'll be when I'm in the mood, not whenever they spring it on me. Although I'm not going to get those other agnosias, like that tonal one. Not yet, anyway. Maybe once those new specs come out. This doesn't mean I agree with my parents having me grow up with Callie. I still think they were wrong. They thought getting rid of beauty would help make a utopia. And I don't believe that at all. Beauty isn't the problem. It's how some people are misusing it. That's the problem. And that's what Callie's good for. It lets you guard against that. I don't know. Maybe this wasn't a problem back in my parents' day. But it's something we have to deal with now.
Story Notes. Tower of Babylon. This story was inspired by a conversation with a friend when he mentioned the version of the Tower of Babel myth he'd been taught in Hebrew school. At that point, I knew only the Old Testament account, and it hadn't made a big impression on me. But in the more elaborate version, the tower is so tall that it takes a year to climb. And when a man falls to his death, no one mourns. But when a brick is dropped, the bricklayers weep because it will take a year to replace. The original legend is about the consequences of defying God. For me, however, the tale conjured up images of a fantastic city in the sky, reminiscent of Magritte's castle in the Pyrenees. I was captivated by the audacity of such a vision, and started wondering what life in such a city would be like. Tom Dish called this story Babylonian science fiction. I hadn't thought about it that way when I was writing it. The Babylonians certainly knew enough physics and astronomy to recognize this story as fanciful, but I understood what he meant. The characters may be religious, but they rely on engineering rather than prayer. No deity makes an appearance in the story. Everything that happens can be understood in purely mechanistic terms. It's in that sense that, despite the obvious difference in cosmology, the universe in the story resembles our own. Understand. This is the oldest story in this volume, and might never have been published if it weren't for Spider Robinson, one of my instructors at Clarion. This story had collected a bunch of rejection slips when I first sent it out, but Spider encouraged me to resubmit it after I had Clarion on my resume. I made some revisions and sent it out, and it got a much better response the second time around. The initial germ for this story was an offhand remark made by a roommate of mine in college. He was reading Sartre's Nausea at the time, whose protagonist finds only meaninglessness in everything he sees. But what would it be like, my roommate wondered, to find meaning and order in everything you saw? To me, that suggested a kind of heightened perception, which in turn suggested superintelligence. I started thinking about the point at which quantitative improvements, better memory, faster pattern recognition, turn into a qualitative difference, a fundamentally different mode of cognition. Something else I wondered about was the possibility of truly understanding how our minds work. Some people are certain that it's impossible for us to understand our minds, offering analogies like, you can't see your face with your own eyes. I never found that persuasive. It may turn out that we can't, in fact, understand our minds, for certain values of understand and mind, but it'll take an argument much more persuasive than that to convince me. Division by zero. There is a famous equation that goes like this. EI plus 1 equals 0. When I first saw the derivation of this equation, my jaw dropped in amazement. Let me try to explain why. One of the things we admire most in fiction is an ending that is surprising, yet inevitable. This is also what characterizes elegance in design. The invention that's clever, yet seems totally natural. Of course, we know that they aren't really inevitable. It's human ingenuity that makes them seem that way, temporarily. Now consider the equation mentioned previously. It's definitely surprising. You could work with the numbers E and I for years,
each in a dozen different contexts, without realizing they intersected in this particular way. Yet once you've seen the derivation, you feel that this equation really is inevitable, that this is the only way things could be. It's a feeling of awe, as if you've come into contact with absolute truth, a proof that mathematics is inconsistent, and that all its wondrous beauty was just an illusion, would, it seemed to me, be one of the worst things you could ever learn. Story of your life. This story grew out of my interest in the variational principles of physics. I found these principles fascinating ever since I first learned of them, but I didn't know how to use them in a story until I saw a performance of Time Flies When You're Alive, Paul Linke's one-man show about his wife's battle with breast cancer. It occurred to me then that I might be able to use variational principles to tell a story about a person's response to the inevitable. A few years later, that notion combined with a friend's remark about her newborn baby to form the nucleus of this story. For those interested in physics, I should note that the story's discussion of Fermat's principle of least time omits all mention of its quantum mechanical underpinnings. The QM formulation is interesting in its own way, but I prefer the metaphoric possibilities of the classical version. As for this story's theme, probably the most concise summation of it that I've seen appears in Kurt Vonnegut's introduction to the 25th anniversary edition of Slaughterhouse-Five. Stephen Hawking found it tantalizing that we could not remember the future. But remembering the future is child's play for me now. I know what will become of my helpless, trusting babies, because they are grown-ups now. I know how my closest friends will end up, because so many of them are retired or dead now. To Stephen Hawking and all others younger than myself, I say, be patient. Your future will come to you and lie down at your feet like a dog who knows and loves you no matter what you are. 72 Letters. This story came about when I noticed a connection between two ideas I previously thought were unrelated. The first one was the golem. In what's probably the best-known story of the golem, Rabbi Lowe of Prague brings a clay statue to life to act as a defender of the Jews, protecting them from persecution. It turns out this story is a modern invention, dating back only to 1909. Stories in which the golem is used as a servant to perform chores, with varying degrees of success, originated in the 1500s. But they still aren't the oldest references to the golem. In stories dating back to the 2nd century, rabbis would animate golems not to accomplish anything practical, but rather to demonstrate mastery of the art of permutating letters. They sought to know God better by performing acts of creation. The whole theme of the creative power of language has been discussed elsewhere, by people smarter than me. What I found particularly interesting about golems was the fact that they're traditionally unable to speak. Since the golem is created through language, this limitation is also a limitation on reproduction. If a golem were able to use language, it would be capable of self-replication, rather like a von Neumann machine. The other idea I'd been thinking about was preformation, the theory that organisms exist fully formed in the germ cells of their parents. It's easy for people now to dismiss it as ridiculous, but at the time, preformation made a lot of sense. It was an attempt to solve the problem of how living organisms are able to replicate themselves, which is the same problem that later inspired von Neumann machines. When I recognized that, it seemed that I was interested in these two ideas for the same reason, and I knew I had to write about them. The Evolution of Human Science. This short was written for the British science journal Nature. Throughout the year 2000, Nature ran a feature called Futures. Each week, a different writer provided a short fictional treatment of a scientific development occurring in the next millennium. Since the piece would appear in a scientific journal, making it about a scientific journal seemed like a natural choice. I started wondering about what such a journal might look like after the advent of superhuman intelligence. William Gibson once said, "The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed." Right now, there are people in the world who,
if they're aware of the computer revolution at all, know of it only as something happening to other people, somewhere else. I expect that will remain true no matter what technological revolutions await us. Hell is the absence of God. I first wanted to write a story about angels after seeing the movie The Prophecy, a supernatural thriller written and directed by Gregory Wyden. For a long time, I tried to think of a story in which angels were characters, but couldn't come up with a scenario I liked. It was only when I started thinking about angels as phenomena of terrifying power, whose visitations resembled natural disasters, that I was able to move forward. Perhaps I was subconsciously thinking of Annie Dillard. Later on, I remembered she once wrote that if people had more belief, they'd wear crash helmets when attending church and lash themselves to the pews. Thinking about natural disasters led to thinking about the problem of innocent suffering. An enormous range of advice has been offered from a religious perspective to those who suffer, and it seems clear that no single response can satisfy everyone. What comforts one person inevitably strikes someone else as outrageous. Consider the book of Job as an example. For me, one of the unsatisfying things about the book of Job is that, in the end, God rewards Job. Leave aside the question of whether new children can compensate for the loss of his original ones. Why does God restore Job's fortunes at all? Why the happy ending? One of the basic messages of the book is that virtue isn't always rewarded. Bad things happen to good people. Job ultimately accepts this, demonstrating virtue, and is subsequently rewarded. Doesn't this undercut the message? It seems to me that the book of Job lacks the courage of its convictions. If the author were really committed to the idea that virtue isn't always rewarded, shouldn't the book have ended with Job still bereft of everything? Liking What You See, a documentary. Psychologists once conducted an experiment where they repeatedly left a fake college application in an airport, supposedly forgotten by a traveler. The answers on the application were always the same, but each time they included a different photo of the fictitious applicant. It turned out people were more likely to mail in the application if the applicant was attractive. This is perhaps not surprising, but it illustrates just how thoroughly we're influenced by appearances. We favor attractive people even in a situation where we'll never meet them. Yet, any discussion of beauty's advantages is usually accompanied by a mention of the burden of beauty. I don't doubt that beauty has its drawbacks, but so does everything else. Why do people seem more sympathetic to the idea of burdensome beauty than to, say, the idea of burdensome wealth? It's because beauty is working its magic again, even in a discussion of its drawbacks. Beauty is providing its possessors with an advantage. I expect physical beauty will be around for as long as we have bodies and eyes. But if kaliagnosia ever becomes available, I, for one, will give it a try. This concludes Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang. Narrated by Todd McLaren and Abby Creighton. Copyright 2002 by Ted Chiang. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Ted Chiang, care of William Morris Endeavor Entertainment, and was produced in the year 2014 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.